Hi, I'm Chris White from the DC Improv Comedy Club. We could all stand to escape into a fantasy world right about now, and that's why you're listening to the first installment of Living the Fairy Tales. In the 1800s, the Brothers Grimm compiled and published more than 60 fairy tales and folk tales. Those stories can be enchanting, bizarre, magical, and cruel, sometimes all at once. But most important, in the year 2020, they're all in the public domain. I cannot stress that enough. We asked people in the DC comedy scene to pick a fairy tale and read us their interpretation, whether it's doing voices, adding sound effects, or chiming in with running commentary. They're recording at home with whatever equipment they have available, then sending it in. Whenever we have a batch of finished fairy tales, we'll put them out to the public. Comedians are volunteering their talent, and all this is presented free of charge, so please do us a favor and make sure you find the comedians online. Follow them on social media, look at their websites, and when life goes back to normal, go see them perform live. And also, please take a second to look at dcimprov.com. On our front page, we have info on how you can support the venue right now, whether it's buying a venue credit or helping out our laid-off staff. But now, the fairy tales. Today, The Fisherman and His Wife, as read by Dylan Vatilana. Old Sultan, as read by Tim Miller. And The Turnip, read by Chris White. The Fisherman and His Wife, as read by Dylan Vatilana. Find Dylan online at dylanstandsup.com.
Well, hello, boys and girls. Today, I'm going to be reading you the story, The Fisherman and His Wife. I do hope you enjoy. There once was a fisherman who lived with his wife in a pigsty, close by the seaside. Oh, this sounds like it's going to rhyme. The fisherman used to go out all day long fishing, and one day he sat on the shore with his rod. Nope, never mind, this doesn't rhyme. He would look at the sparkling waves and watch his line, when all of a sudden his float was dragged away deep into the water, and in drawing it in, he pulled out a great fish. But the fish said, "Pray let me live. I am not a real fish. I am an enchanted prince. Put me in the water again and let me go." The man replied to the fish, "Oh ho, you need not make so many words about the matter. I will have nothing to do with a fish that can talk. So swim away now, sir, soon as you please." Then he put him back in the water, and the fish darted straight down to the bottom and left a long streak of blood behind him on the wave. That was unnecessary. When the fish went home to his wife in the pigsty, he told her how he caught a great fish and how it had told him it was an enchanted prince. But upon hearing the fish speak, he let the fish go.
"Did you not ask for anything?" said the wife. "We live in a wretchedy place here. It is nasty, dirty, it's a pigsty. Do go back and tell the fish we want a snug little cottage."
The fisherman did not much like this, but he was a pushover, so he went to the seashore, and when he came back, the water looked all yellow and green. He stood at the water's edge and said, "Oh, man of the sea, hearken to me. My wife Isabel will have her own will, and hath sent me to beg a boon of thee." Then the fish came swimming to him and said,
Whoa, what was that? Was that English? What are you reading me a poetry from college right now? Speak normally, jeez. All right, what is her will? What does she want? What does your wife want?"
"Well," said the fisherman, "my wife said that when I had caught you, I ought to have asked you for something before I let you go. She does not like living in a pigsty and wants a snug little cottage."
"Oh, okay, so you both assume that since I can talk, I have to have magical powers or something. Well, I don't. I just have very good connections." "Go home," said the fish. "I just so happen to have a cottage guy. He owes me a few favors from a few years back. You will have your cottage by the time you return."
So the man went home and saw his wife standing at the door of a nice, trim little cottage.
"Come in, come in," she said. "This is not much better than the filthy pigsty we had."
There was a parlor and a bedchamber, which is old speak for bedroom, and a kitchen, and behind the cottage there was a little garden planted with all sorts of flowers and fruits, and there was a courtyard behind full of ducks and chickens. Ah, said the fisherman, how happily we shall live now.
We will try to do so, at least, said his wife.
Everything went right for about a week or two. Then Isabel said,
Husband, there is not near enough room for us in this cottage. The courtyard and the garden are a great deal too small. I should like to have a large stone castle to live in. Go to the fish again, go to him, and tell him to give us a castle.
But wife, said the fisherman, I should not go to him again, for perhaps he will be angry. We ought to be fine with this pretty little cottage of ours.
Oh, that's nonsense, said the wife. He will do it very willingly. I know fish, trust me. Go along now and try.
The fisherman thought to himself, I know fish. What does that even mean, anyway? But he went anyways, with his heart heavy. And when he came to the sea, though the water was very calm, it looked blue and gloomy. He went very close to the edge of the waves and said, O man of the sea, hearken to me. My wife Isabel will have her own will, and hath sent me to beg a boon of thee.
All right, what did I tell you about this gibberish, man? Is this some language you invented? English, please, speak it. All right, well, what does she want now? What does she want now?
Said the fish. Said the man dolefully, my wife wants to live in a stone castle. The fish replied,
Well, you are in luck, because I just so happen to know of a stone castle that, fell off the back of a truck. Go home, your wife is standing at the gate already.
You see this?
She said.
Is this not a grand castle?
And with that they went into the castle together, and found a great many servants there. The rooms were all richly furnished, full of chairs and tables, and one leopard-print love-seat couch, which the fisherman thought was a bit tacky, but looked comfortable enough, I guess. And behind the castle was a garden, and around it was a park a half a mile long, full of sheep and goats and rabbits and deer. Well, said the man, now we will live cheerfully and happily in this beautiful castle for the rest of our lives.
Perhaps we may, said Isabel, but let us sleep upon it before we make up our minds to that.
So they went to bed. The next morning, when Isabel awoke, it was broad daylight, and she lightly woke the fisherman with her elbow.
Oi! 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 Get up, husband, and bestir yourself, for we must be king of all the land.
The man replied, But wife, why should we wish to be king? I will not be king. That seems too burdensome.
Then I will be king, she said.
But wife, said the fisherman, how can you be king? The fish cannot make you a king.
Husband,
she said,
say no more about it, but go and try. I will be king.
So the man went away in much sorrow, to think that his wife should want to be king. This time the sea looked a dark grey colour, and was overspread with curling waves and ridges of foam. And he cried out, O man of the sea, hearken to me. My wife Isabel will have her own will, and hath sent me to beg a boon of thee.
Okay, so we're just going to continue with this jibber-jabber nonsense you spew out. Whatever. Just move the story along, I guess. What does she want now? Said the fish.
Alas, said the poor man, my wife wishes to be king.
Go home, then, said the fish. She is king already. It is done.
Then the fisherman went home, and as he came close to the palace, he saw a troop of soldiers and heard the sounds of drums and trumpets. And when he went in, he saw his wife sitting atop a throne made of gold and diamonds, bling, bling. She had a golden crown placed upon her head, and on each side of her stood six fair maidens, each a head taller than the next, I don't know why their heights were important, but the author decided to include that.
Well, 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 my pretty wife, said the fisherman. Are you now king?
Yes, I am, she said. I am king now.
And after he had looked at her for a long time, he said,
Oh, wife, what a fine thing it is for you to be king. Surely you won't want anything more, and we can end this story now at the height of our happiness, because everyone knows fairy tales like this never end well.
I don't know, she said. I am king, it is true, but I begin to be tired of that, and I think I should be emperor next.
Alas, my wife, why should you wish to be emperor? Aren't king and emperor basically like the same thing anyways? Said the fisherman.
Silence, husband. Go to the fish. I say I will be emperor.
Ah, wife, replied the fisherman. The fish cannot make an emperor, I am sure of that. I should not like to ask him for such a thing.
I am king, said Isabel. You are my slave, so go at once.
And so the fisherman was forced to go back to the sea, and muttered to himself along as he went.
Oh, so I'm a slave now? Oh, is that it? Is that it? I'm a slave? That's fine. I thought we was just married, but it's whatever. This will come to no good. It is too much to ask. The fish will be tired at last, and then we shall be sorry for what we have done.
See, children, this is called foreshadowing. He soon came to the seashore, and the water was quite black and muddy, and a mighty whirlwind blew over the waves and rolled them about. But he went near as he could to the water's brink and said,
O man of the sea, hearken to me. My wife Isabel will have her own will and hath sent me to beg a boon of thee.
Come on, man. You literally just left like 20 minutes ago. Like, what does she want now? What would she have now? Said the fish.
Ah, said the fisherman. She wants to be emperor now.
Ah, okay. I see. I thought king and emperor were synonymous, but hey, I'm just a prince imprisoned inside a magically enchanted fish body. What do I know? All right, go home and I will make her an emperor. Okay, go.
So he went home again, and as he came near, he saw his wife, Isabel, sitting on a very lofty throne made of solid gold, with two great crowns adorning her head. And on each side of her stood her guards and attendants in row, each one smaller than the next, from the tallest giant down to the littlest dwarf, which is probably a politically incorrect term, but we'll move on. And before her stood princes and dukes and earls, and off in the corner was that same tacky leopard print couch.
The fisherman walked up. We gotta get rid of that couch or something, or move it to the basement. I don't know, it just looks bad. Wife, you are now emperor!
Yes, she said. I am emperor now.
Ah, said the man as he gazed upon her. What a fine thing it must be to be emperor and all.
Husband, she said, why should I stop at being emperor? I wish to be pope next.
Oh, wife, he said, how can you be pope? There is but one pope at a time, and I don't believe he's willing to give up such a cushy position. I know I wouldn't.
Husband, she said, I will be pope this very day. Make it happen.
But, replied the husband, the fish cannot make you pope. That is ordained by God, him or herself.
What total utter nonsense, she said. If he can make me emperor, he can make me pope. Go and try him then. Go along. Go.
And so the fisherman went. But when he came to the shore, the wind was raging, and the sea was tossing up and down in boiling waves, and the boats carrying shipments of khaki cargo shorts from Vietnam were toppling over, spilling into the ocean. In the middle of the heavens, there was only a little piece of blue sky. But towards the south was all red, as if a dreadful storm was rising. At this sight, the fisherman was dreadfully frightened, and he trembled so that his knees knocked together. But he still went down to the shore and said, "O man of the sea, hearken to me. My wife Isabel will have her own will, and hath sent me to beg a boon of thee."
"Jeez, this woman is insatiable. Look, man, I know it's a little late in the game to ask you this, but is your marriage okay? She seems to want more and more. I'm starting to get the notion that she's not feeling, fulfilled at home, if you catch my drift," said the fish.
"Ah, you are gonna love this one. When I tell you, you're gonna love this one. My wife wants to be Pope now. Isn't she such a silly goose?"
All right. Go home," said the fish. "She is Pope now."
Then the fisherman went home and found Isabel sitting on a throne that was 2 miles high. That's way too tall. And she had 3 great crowns on her head, because apparently the more crowns you wear, the more power you have. And around her stood all the pomp and power of the church. And on each side of her were 2 rows of burning lights of all sizes. And diamonds and rubies adorned the tacky leopard print love seat that was now pushed to the back of the room out of the way.
"Wife," said the fisherman, as he looked at all of this greatness, "are you Pope now? Am I married to the Pope now?"
Yes, I am Pope now," she said.
Well, wife," he replied.
"It is a great thing to be Pope, and now you must be easy, for you can want nothing more, right? Please say right."
"I will think about that," said the wife.
And then they went to bed, but Pope Isabel could not sleep all night, for she was thinking what should be next. As morning broke and the sun rose, "Ah," she thought, as she woke up and looked toward the window,
"after all, I cannot prevent the sun from rising and setting."
At this thought, she was very depressed and angry, and wakened her husband and said,
Husband, get up, husband. Go down to the fish and tell him I must be the lord of the sun and the moon."
The fisherman was half asleep.
"What time is it? I still got the sleepy in my eyes."
But her nudge knocked him out of bed.
"Alas, my wife," he said. "Can you not be easy with being Pope? I mean, your sister Julia, she still works at Quiznos. Don't you have enough over her?"
"No," she said. "I am very uneasy as long as the sun and the moon rise without my leave. Go to the fish at once."
So the man went shivering in fear. And as he was going down to the shore that was now covered in khaki cargo shorts, a dreadful storm arose, so that the trees and the very rocks shook, and all the heavens became black with stormy clouds, and the lightning flashed, and the thunder roared, and the sea wished and washed, with great black waves swelling up like a mountain with crowns of white foam upon their heads, and the fishermen crept towards the sea. He was army crawling at this point because he was terrified and he had peed himself, and cried out as well as he could, "O man of the sea, hearken to me. My wife Isabel will have her own will and has sent me to beg a boon of thee."
"Let me guess. She's not happy being Pope. A woman unhappy being the most powerful human in the world. What a surprise," said the fish.
"Ah," he said, "she wants to be lord of the sun and the moon."
All right. I got something for you guys. Go home," said the fish, "and go back to your pigsty."
And to this day, they still live in that pigsty with that tacky leopard-printed love seat. The end. Now, what did we learn today, boys and girls? What was the moral of that story? Was it to be happy with what you already have and not want for more? Perhaps. Was it that material things you collect will never bring you true joy because true happiness comes from within? Maybe. No, the true moral of that story is that if you are in an unhappy marriage, do not drag a talking fish into it. Just get a divorce like every other adult and see what's up with that sister, Julia. Employees at Quiznos get a 15% discount on selected subs, so that relationship would basically pay for itself in like 2 or 3 months. Well, it hath been a pleasure reading to you all today. My name is Dylan Vatalana, and I would like you to stay safe and stay reading, my friends.
Find Dylan online at dylanstandsup.com. Old Sultan, as read by Tim Miller. Find Tim online at timmillercomedy.com.
A shepherd had a faithful dog called Sultan, who was grown very old and had lost all his teeth. And one day when the shepherd and his wife were standing together before the house, the shepherd said, "I'm going to shoot old Sultan tomorrow morning. He getting old, he just of no use to us." But his wife said,
"You gonna let that dog live? He served us so well all these years. We ought to give him a livelihood for the rest of his days."
"But what can we do?" said the shepherd. "He don't have no teeth in his head. He ain't got no teeth in his head. And the thieves don't care for him at all. They ain't scared. They almost stole him. To be sure, he has served, but did he earn his livelihood? Look, tomorrow's going to be his last day. Trust me." Poor Sultan, who was lying close by, heard all that the shepherd and his wife said to one another and was very frightened to think tomorrow would be his last day. So in the evening, he went to his good friend, the wolf, who lived in the wood, and told him all his sorrows. And now his master meant to kill him in the morning.
"Make yourself easy," said the wolf. "I will give you good guidance, good advice. Your master, you know, goes out every morning early with his wife into the field, and they take their little child with them and lay it down beside the edge in the shade while they're at work. Now you will go. You will lie down close by the child and pretend to be watching it, and I will come out of the wood and run away with it. You must run after me as fast as you can, and I will let it drop. Then you may carry it back, and they will think you have saved their child and will be so thankful to you that they will take care of you as long as you live."
The dog liked this plan very well, and accordingly so it was managed. The wolf ran with the child a little way. The shepherd and his wife screamed out,
"Get the baby!
But Sultan soon overtook him and carried the poor little thing back to his master and mistress. Then the shepherd patted him on the head and said,
Good boy.
"Oh, Sultan has saved? Boy, you saved my baby from that dirty old wolf. We gonna take care of you, boy. You gonna be taken care of. You gonna have plenty of food to eat. Wife, go home and give him a good dinner and let him sleep on my old cushion as long as he lives." So from this time forward, Sultan had all that he could wish for. Soon afterwards, the wolf came and wished him joy and said,
"Now, good fellow, you must tell me no tales, but turn your head the other way when I want to grab one of those old shepherd's fine fat sheep."
"No," said the Sultan, "I will be true to my master."
"It sounds like you said no. That's a good joke."
And came one night to get a dainty morsel. But Sultan had told his master what the wolf meant to do. So he laid wait for him behind the barn door, and when the wolf was busy looking for a good fat sheep, he had a stout cudgel laid about his back that combed his locks for him finely. Then the wolf was very angry and called Sultan an old rogue and swore he would have his revenge. So the next morning, the wolf sent the boar to challenge Sultan to come into the wood to fight the matter. Now, Sultan had nobody he could ask to be his second but the shepherd's old three-legged cat. So he took her with him. And as the poor thing limped along with some trouble, she stuck up her tail straight in the air. The wolf and the wild boar were first on the ground, and when they espied their enemies coming and saw the cat's long tail standing straight in the air, they thought she was carrying a sword for Sultan to fight with. And every time she limped, they thought she was picking up a stone to throw at him. So they said they should not like this way of fighting, and the boar lay down behind a bush, and the wolf jumped up into a tree. Sultan and the cat soon came up and looked about and wondered that no one was there. The boar, however, had not quite hidden himself, for his ears stuck out of the bush. And when he shook one of them a little, the cat, seeing something move and thinking it was a mouse, sprang upon it and bit and scratched it, so that the boar jumped up and grunted and ran away, roaring out, "Look up in the trees! He's up there! That's the one you need to blame!" So they looked up and espied the wolf sitting amongst the branches, as they called him a cowardly rascal, and would not suffer him to come down till he was heartily ashamed of himself and had promised to be good friends again with old Sultan.
Find Tim Miller online at timmillercomedy.com. The Turnip, as read by Chris White. Find Chris online at chriswhitedc.com. And although this sounds like it might be a coming-of-age movie starring Lil Bow Wow, it is actually Turnip with an I, as in the vegetable. Sorry to disappoint, but we'll get through it. There were two brothers who were both soldiers. The one was rich and the other poor. Okay, one sentence in, we should all be pumped. First, the brothers have the same job, but one is rich and one is poor. So clearly there's going to be some drug addiction or a gambling problem or a really nasty divorce. Fairy tales don't strictly have to have morals, but right now I'm thinking, don't do drugs. Let's see if I'm right. The poor man thought he would try to better himself. So, pulling off his red coat, he became a gardener and dug his ground well and sowed turnips. Yeah, his plan to improve his life is to grow turnips, so now we know this is a story about drugs, for sure, 100%. This is going to be fun. Turnip, 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 turnip! When the seed came up, there was one plant bigger than all the rest, and it kept getting larger and larger, and seemed as if it would never cease growing, so that it might have been called the Prince of Turnips, for there never was such a one seen before, and never will again. Okay, nice little curveball. Now I kind of want this to be the Little Shop of Horrors. Also, I am not sure why it would be the Prince of Turnips and not the King of Turnips, unless in the turnip government the prince is the real power behind the throne. Either way, we now have a drug-addicted ex-soldier and a giant vegetable that may or may not be a euphemism for genitalia or an alien thirsty for blood. This story rules. At last, it was so big that it filled a cart, and two oxen could hardly draw it, and the gardener knew not what in the world to do with it, nor whether it would be a blessing or a curse to him. One day he said to himself, "What shall I do with it? If I sell it, it will bring no more than another. And for eating, the little turnips are better than this. The best thing, perhaps, is to carry it and give it to the king as a mark of respect." See, ladies, there is such a thing as too big. Yeah. And that's our new moral. Size doesn't matter.
Turnip, 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 turnip.
Also, I think we can all agree that nothing says respect quite like the gift of a turnip. How many mafia feuds could have been avoided with the timely gift of a large turnip? Turnips show respect, beets show regret, and cauliflower says, "Girl, it's time to smash."
Turnip, 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 turnip.
Then he yoked his oxen and drew the turnip to the court and gave it to the king. "What a wonderful thing," said the king. "I have seen many strange things, but such a monster as this I never saw. Where did you get the seed? Or is it only your good luck? If so, you are a true child of fortune. And I think we should all be enjoying that the king is basically a judge at the Indiana State Fair. Ah, no, answered the gardener. I am no child of fortune. I am a poor soldier, who never could get enough to live upon. So I laid aside my red coat and set to work tilling the ground. I have a brother who is rich, and your majesty knows him well, and all the world knows him. But because I am poor, everybody forgets me. Oh, snap, the Brothers Grimm dropping truth bombs! Just remember, if you feel like you're poor and the world doesn't care about your problems, you're no different than an 18th century German turnip farmer. And the way out is to grow turnips. The king then took pity on him and said, You shall be poor no longer. I will give you so much that you shall be even richer than your brother. Then he gave him gold and lands and flocks and made him so rich that his brother's fortune could not at all be compared with his. All right, so now we've established the king as some kind of weird puppet master playing brother against brother. He's probably the kind of guy who would ask you to have sex with the queen while he sat at the foot of the bed and watched smoking a cigarette from one of those long-handled cigarette holders. Good guy. I like this king. This is the kind of leadership we need in the 21st century, and I think we should really get back to government-based around produce. Also, the king values the gift of a large turnip over a lifetime of exemplary service serving as a soldier, which, did turnip mean something different back then? Was it a euphemism for, like, I don't know, like hookers or something? I'm really, really looking forward to the moral of this story. Here we go. When the brother heard of all this, and how a turnip had made the gardener so rich, he envied him sorely, and bethought himself how he could contrive to get the same good fortune for himself. Yeah, here we go. Buckle the hell up. However, he determined to manage more cleverly than his brother, and got together a rich present of gold and fine horses for the king, and thought he must have a much larger gift in return, for if his brother had received so much for only a turnip, what must his present be worth? Quick note on economics, if the king just rewards every present from a random a-hole by giving them an even bigger present, that is just really bad fiscal policy, and the entire economy would collapse from hyperinflation. I mean, word gets out, eventually every dip and moron in the kingdom is showing up with giant carrots and giant rutabagas, and then you're printing money just to finance your large vegetable collection. I mean, this is just basic economics. Come on. The king took the gift very graciously, and said he knew not what to give in return, more valuable and wonderful than the great turnip. Boom, 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 boom. So the soldier was forced to put it into a cart and drag it home with him. All right, so the king re-gifted the turnip, which, by the way, has to be smelling pretty bad at this point. This king rules. Beyond that, no one can figure out how to monetize a giant turnip? Really? I know Instagram wasn't a thing back then, but I really believe, deep in my heart, that if this turnip existed in modern times, it would have its own account with 3 million followers, and people would be paying it appearance fees to show up at bat mitzvahs with the cast from Vanderpump Rules. Anyway, new frontrunner for the moral of this story, regifting is wrong. Anyhow, any bets on how graciously the brother receives this gift? Huh? When he reached home, he knew not upon whom to vent his rage and spite. And at length wicked thoughts came to his head, and he resolved to kill his brother. All right, so he handled it well. That escalated quickly. This makes very little sense, because as a family, now everyone is rich, and they have the rights to the turnip. They beat the system here, is the point. So new moral, more money, more problems. Turnip, 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 turnip! So he hired some villains to murder him. Clearly because he has never watched a single show on ID Network. That's Bush League, dude. Having shown them where to lie in ambush, he went to his brother and said, Dear brother, I have found a hidden treasure. Let us go and dig it up and share it between us. The other had no suspicions of his roguery, so they went out together. And as they were traveling along, the murderers rushed out upon him, bound him, and were going to hang him on a tree. And this is also horse crap, because I have two brothers who I love dearly, and if either one of them came to me with this plan, I would immediately know they were trying to kill me. We didn't like to share the couch or Nintendo games, and they are not coming to me with buried treasure. So at some point, it's just on you, you dumb turnip-growing bastard. But whilst the villains were getting all ready, they heard the trampling of a horse at a distance, which so frightened them that they pushed their prisoner neck and shoulders together into a sack and swung him up by a cord to the tree, where they left him dangling, and ran away. Meantime, he worked and worked away, till he made a hole large enough to put out his head. And now I feel like we're in a Coen Brothers movie, or Winnie the Pooh, or both. I don't think it matters anymore. Just so we're clear, these guys were hired to murder someone in cold blood. They ran away because they heard the trampling of a horse at a distance. If you're shopping around for a Ring doorbell, save your money. All you need is a non-stop audio loop of a horse trampling at a distance. How many lives could we save? How many mass shootings could we stop if we just used the time-honored, evidence-based strategy of horses trampling at a distance? How different America might have been if some horses had trampled through the third floor of the Texas Book Depository in November 1963. Think about it, won't you? Then stop and maybe slam your head in a door. Yeah. When the horseman came up, he proved to be a student, a merry fellow, who was journeying along on his nag and singing as he went. Turnip, 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 turnip. No one likes that guy. Don't be that guy. I used to be a whistler in college and everyone on campus hated me, probably for lots of reasons other than the whistling too, but the whistling definitely did not help. As soon as the man in the sack saw him passing under the tree, he cried out, good morning to thee, my friend. The student looked about everywhere, and seeing no one, and not knowing where the voice came from, cried out, who calls me? Then the man in the tree answered, lift up thine eyes, for behold, here I sit in the sack of wisdom. Actually, you know what? Let's back up a second. I know I can hit that one better. Give me a second. Hold on. Loosen up the old throat. Here we go. Lift up thine eyes, for behold, here I sit in the sack of wisdom. Yeah, nailed it. Turn up, turn up, turn up, turn up. Here have I, in a short time, learned great and wondrous things. Compared to this seat, all the learning of the schools is as empty air. A little longer, and I shall know all that man can know, and shall come forth wiser than the wisest of mankind. Here I discern the signs and motions of the heavens and the stars, the laws that control the winds, the number of the sands on the seashore, the healing of the sick, the virtues of all simples, of birds, and of precious stones. Wert thou but once here, my friend, thou wouldst feel and own the power of knowledge. So the sack of wisdom is basically the same thing as reading Wikipedia articles until 4 a.m. while drinking malt liquor. The student listened to all this and wondered much. At last he said, blessed be the day and hour when I found you. Cannot you contrive to let me into the sack for a little while? Then the other answered, as if very unwillingly, a little space I may allow thee to sit here, if thou wilt reward me well and entreat me kindly. But thou must tarry yet an hour below, till I have learnt some little matters that are yet unknown to me. What the hell is going on here? He can't just ask the nice singing dork to untie him from a tree? He's trying to trick him into doing it, and he's playing hard to get. What is the end game here? Has this guy experienced any personal growth? And where is the turnip? We have completely lost the narrative. It's the titular character. What was going on in 18th century Germany that made this okay? Jeez, 20th century Germany is making a lot more sense, right? Ah, all right, back to the singing dork. So the student sat himself down and waited a while, but the time hung heavy upon him, and he begged earnestly that he might ascend forthwith, for his thirst for knowledge was great. Then the other pretended to give way, and said, thou must let the sack of wisdom descend, by untying yonder cord, and then thou shalt enter. All right, new best guess as to the moral. When the sack drops, you become a man. I don't know, this whole thing is off the rails. Turn up, turn up, turn up, turn up, turn up! So the student let him down, opened the sack, and set him free. Now then, cried he, let me ascend quickly. And he began to put himself into the sack, heels first. Wait a while, said the gardener, that is not the way. Then he pushed him in head first, tied up the sack, and soon swung up the searcher after wisdom, dangling in the air. How is it with thee, friend, said he, dost thou not feel that wisdom comes unto thee? Rest there in peace, till thou art a wiser man than thou wert." So saying, he trotted off on the student's nag, and left the poor fellow to gather wisdom till somebody should come and let him down. And that is the end. Really, there are no more words for me to read right now. If the ending of the Matrix trilogy had a baby with the ending of Game of Thrones, and that baby was somehow surgically grafted to another baby that was the child of the ending of The Sopranos and the ending of Lost, that resulting monstrosity would not be a worse ending than the one we just experienced together, and for that I am deeply, deeply sorry. The Gardener's big takeaway, after experiencing unfathomable generosity and also surviving attempted fratricide, two big character-building opportunities, is to F over a stranger by committing the 18th century German equivalent of Grand Theft Auto, and to leave his victim stuck in a tree in the woods, which, as we all know, in German fairy tales means something bad's about to happen. Yeah, we're not going out like that. New ending. The soldier returned home, frustrated that his insanely dumb plan, far worse than what a meth head would make, did not work. Spying the turnip sitting in its cart in his driveway, he was filled with rage and kicked the cartwheel in anger, at which point the wheel broke. So much for superior German engineering, and the turnip spilled out of the cart, landing squarely on top of the soldier and exploding him in a giant red cloud of mist and gore. He died instantly. But the turnip continued to roll, down the hill, on the road to the forest, an unstoppable juggernaut of death and vengeance. Naturally, it squashed the gardener, who was riding out of the woods, on his stolen horse, back to his fabulous estate, which he got in return for said turnip. How's that for irony? Yes, he was reduced to a giant pile of goo instantaneously. Never saw it coming. But the horse was fine somehow. Don't worry about the horse. No horses were harmed in the making of this much better ending. Finally, the turnip slowed to a halt directly underneath the student. And it was such a large turnip that the student, who was by now realizing what an idiot he had been, could put his feet upon it and get his footing and escape. He married that turnip out of gratitude. And the king, upon hearing the story of their love, was so moved that he abdicated in favor of the turnip. The end.
Turnip, 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 turnip.
Thanks for listening to Living the Fairy Tales Volume 1, and a very special thank you to Dylan Vatilana and Tim Miller. Check them out online, dylanstandsup.com and timmillercomedy.com. And if you'd like to help support the DC Improv Comedy Club, head over to dcimprov.com for more information on how to do that. You can purchase venue credits. For your $20, we will give you $25 back to spend on tickets when life gets back to normal. Again, all the info on that is at dcimprov.com, and you can also read about our efforts to help our staff through these tough times. We hope to be back with more fairy tales soon, but in the meantime, however you're writing out this current situation, please make sure you find the time to laugh. It does a world of good.